Keep the freelance, that's what I'm saying. Keep the Facebook connections coming in. Talking about the kind of quirky things that you do in your life, a la me, which is that I like to read the last page of a book when I've been reading maybe two or three pages, and then I think, oh, is that person still alive? And then I need to check at the end of the book, and they're okay. And like, I watched the end of the Wallabies All Blacks match this morning after I'd recorded it, just to see what the score was, so I could then go back and watch the last 20 minutes. This is pathetic. I was actually telling Rose, who was just in the studio, that that I'm not like that with everything. I don't need to know where a conversation, I don't give all of my guests, you know, this is the question, this is the list of questions I'll be asking, and this is the direction it's going to take. In fact, as my next guest will attest, that is the furthest from the way in which this program works. The furthest description. Stilgherrian is a freelance journalist, he's a commentator, he's a podcaster, and we talk about the big picture internet issues, particularly around the world of security. Nice to see you in the flesh.
In the flesh, Lindy.
Great nice to have you along. Finally. Normally you're in our Sydney studios, that's and we're right. grateful for that. But you're in Melbourne because you've been to a hacker conference.
That's right.
Oh, that just makes me happier than you know.
Why happy?
Because I love to think that the fact that the whole world of hacking is coming out from underneath the rock from where I thought it was living for a long period of time and, you know, and coming into the light. It's going to be used for good as well as evil still.
Well, that's right. And look, the word hacker, if you talk to hackers, they get angry because it's become associated with criminality.
Oh, so and what was it? Why was it? What was it normally?
Well, the word hacker actually goes back a century or so to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, one of the great engineering universities of the United States. And someone who was a hacker was someone who could do cool hacks. They could take a bit of equipment and make it do things it wasn't designed to do. So back in the day, it might have been, oh, I don't know, hotting up a petrol engine or taking something that was meant to be some sort of mechanical or electronic equipment and adapting and doing something unexpected and really clever with it. And that was called a neat hack.
That's nice. I had no idea. I love that stuff.
Yeah. And so a hacker was someone, it was a mark of respect. It
yes.
was someone who was a true hacker who could just think outside the box.
And has it not been used really since then? Because I haven't heard much about it since.
It has, but the thing that in the early days of the internet, when it was, you know, only a few tens of thousands of computers or 100,000 or whatever it might be, up to about a million, you know, the people who used the internet were also the people who were building it. And to get on the early internet, and people forget that the internet is more than 40 years old.
Oh, stop, yes.
1967, was it? Look, but either way, it began by connecting universities that did defence funding. Defence-funded research, I should say, in the United States. And so the people connecting these big computers between different universities were the computing scientists, they were the physicists, they were the people who were going to use the computers. So they were very technically adept. Then as the internet spread out into the wider community, before there were commercial internet service providers and you just, you know, plonk down a credit card and get an account, you had to actually be able to wire it up yourself. And that's how I first connected to the internet in the very early 1990s, I think it was. It was certainly before we had commercial internet service providers in the mid-1990s. And so you had to have a technical knowledge. But at the same time, the people doing this are driven by curiosity.
They wanted to play with it.
That's right. So if you found a way to log into NASA's computer systems and have a look around, well, you did. If you could log into your local telephone exchange, which is just another kind of computer these days, well, you did, and you looked around and you kind of played and you tried not to break anything because then they'd notice you were there and so on. Now, the kind of first wave of hackers were driven by this curiosity. Then, of course, as it grew in any society, some of the people weren't necessarily the most honest people
right,
around.
Right.
So then we started to see the first criminal hackers, as it were. And they were doing minor bits and pieces. And then the next wave was when organised crime started to say, well, hang on, once we have commercial stuff on the internet, that means money is starting to flow there, or at least information related to money. And so then the third wave was hackers being hired by the organised criminals so that, yeah, you can do the hacking, we'll do the crime. We'll help you, you know, understand how to pick a target, how to launder the money so you don't get caught, all of those things. And that was the kind of third wave as it moved into organised criminal hacking. Now, that said, all of the young folk coming up through the thing were still driven by curiosity
and
whatever.
Of course, yeah, so it sort of them, still has a link with what the original word
right.
meant.
That's right. And then eventually we get to the point where we are today, and we call it all cyber now. Everything is cyber. And that kind of goes with nation-state actors, as they say, by which we mean spooks, spies, and so on. And
nation-state actors.
Yes, that's so you can just blur. That's the political jargon. So you can blur out. You're not specifically saying who it is. You're not saying whether it's that nation's military or whether it's their spies or whether it's some cut-out organisation that's funded by the nation-state. You know, the hiring mercenaries, as it were, online. But it's grown. And now that we have 2.5 billion people using the internet out of a world population of 7 billion, so it's kind of still a few people to get on board. You know, there's so much money flowing through the place, so much information, that all of the kinds of things that happened in the physical world about spying, about industrial espionage, about people stealing things, well, that's just reflected in the real world.
Of course it is, because it's run by humans.
Well, that's right. And humans, some are good, some are bad, some are, you know, evil, some are honest, some are not. And so really we're at the point now where everything that exists in the physical realm of human society is reflected somewhere on the internet. And again, we shouldn't be surprised by that.
I guess not. But when you do a conference then on hacking, do you concentrate on a particular area, or do you reveal the ways in which the mafia, or the ways in which the spooks of the world, or do you find, you know, how is it put together?
Well, there's a range of them, of hacker conferences, that is. And this one, like RuxCon, the one that's been held in Melbourne, this was its 11th year, 650 people there. You've really got a gathering of people who are looking at hacking or information security or those related areas from a number of directions. But RuxCon is your more community-based conference, so it tends to be a younger audience. It's people learning the tricks, as they were. But just like any conference, it's people presenting their knowledge, others learning from it, a bit of social networking happening, so you kind of meet people who are working on similar problems to you. So you do have, in this case, I think there were 28 or so presentations, which are usually saying, well, I started having a look at Apple Pay, the Apple payment system, to see whether it was as secure as it ought to be, and here's what I found.
Right.
Or I've been experimenting around with some bit of technology, and this is what I discovered. So often you'll find that someone has attacked a problem for the first time and go, oh, this particular manufacturer, they really haven't been paying attention to security. And 2 years ago at another hacking conference, one of the big subjects was smart TVs. I mean, a smart TV is really a computer without a keyboard.
I guess.
Sits on your wall.
Yes.
But they've got a camera and a microphone in them so that they can either just watch your gestures, or, you know, you can use them for Skype conversations with grandma in London or whatever it might be. But it is a computer hanging on the wall with a camera and a microphone
that
in your
hotel
bedroom.
That you pay no attention
bedroom.
To, you
so
never you think of.
Yeah, and it's plugged in permanently. And a young hacker from Korea showed us very nicely how a certain model of smart TV, which we could all see in front of us, so we saw his name was on the maker's plate, he not only showed how you could hack it, he showed us 10 different ways of hacking it, depending on how you wanted to get in, and he showed us how you could have it using its camera and microphone to stream live video of whatever was in front of the TV out to the internet, except it looked like it was turned off because the power light
wasn't
lit.
Get serious.
Absolutely
so
serious.
So would people now have that particular model television in their homes? Because everyone's thinking, is it my TV? Is it my TV?
It was a few years old, but yes. The company in question has immediately hired him to be a security consultant and help sort that out.
Yeah.
But it is fair to say that smart TVs of a few years ago are a terrible security risk. And as this guy quite nicely put it at the end of his presentation, do not put the smart TV in the bedroom.
No.
Or the hotel room.
Yeah.
Or the corporate boardroom or the school classroom or anywhere. So look at that. That sounds very scary, and it is, because once more, another whole generation of equipment is being connected to the internet without people thinking of the safety and security implications.
And even if you think that you haven't got, if you have a smart TV that you don't actually use in that way, that you use because most TVs are smart these days.
That's right.
So if you buy it, but you still just use your laptop or your pad or something to connect with the internet, and you don't use it in that way, are you still?
Well, if you don't connect it to the internet, you're fine. But then.
Most people
get their smart TV connected to the internet so they can watch streaming movies from one of the new services.
Can you protect yourself from that?
Well, you need to keep in touch with the manufacturer issuing software updates just like you do for your phone, your computer,
and just
whatever.
Be aware of what potentially you might want to in front of that television.
And turn it off when you're not using it. Unplug it from the wall. Put a little sticker over the camera. That's the best one,
that's good.
I think. And if I show you here, I've got a laptop in front of me.
Yes.
On top of the camera, I've got a little sticky thing to cover up the camera.
You have. Oh, that's good. Okay, everyone, there you go. There's some very good advice.
You can do that with the camera on your smartphone too. Just cover it up. You don't need to do anything fancy. Just get a kind of sticky note, tear off a strip, stick
it
on
there.
And just have it there. Or, a Band-Aid, anything. Just cover it up. That's not very attractive, obviously.
No, but that's all right. But what you've got is actually looks like it's been made for the job.
It is made for the job. And at a previous conference earlier in the month, which was the professional end of information security, I mean, like at any conference, right, the vendors are handing out all sorts of giveaways. And there's your usual pens and coffee cups and all of that rubbish. But many of them also hand out useful things, and one of them handed out a pad of little stickers to put over the cameras of all your devices.
Wow. I wonder if people can buy those online. I'm sure they can find it.
Oh, yeah.
Just put in something to a sort of a search engine. It says, little sticky thing to cover up cameras on my laptop.
That's right. There. Or just a bit of sticky paper would do the job.
Still, Gary is here. He helps us because, we need to know what to be afraid of, and we need to know what to do when we are afraid. I want to get to the dark web or the dark net, because this is a question that's come from a number of people over the last months that we've been talking still, and you haven't had time, and I want to leave you plenty of time to dig in.
This is such a world, isn't it?
Because it is such a world. So A, it does exist.
Yeah, look, the term dark web really in that form, it's kind of a tabloid newspaper term for that. It's like calling a suburb which has a slightly higher than average crime rate, a city of fear, and all of that stuff. But it really just means the parts of the internet that don't advertise their presence and, in fact, deliberately hide from discovery. So they are trying to conceal where they might be physically. If people have heard of Tor, the tool for helping hide your internet location when you're using it to anonymously... I don't know. It was originally written, funnily enough, by the US Naval Research Laboratory to help their agents in the field hide the fact where they were coming from. I mean, you really don't want to be sitting there in an unnamed Middle Eastern country, connect back to your handler at CIA headquarters or wherever it might be, and, hello, why is this person here connecting to the CIA connection? That trouble. So all Tor does is bounce your internet traffic randomly amongst, I don't know, a dozen, 20 different random locations on the internet, essentially everyone else using the Tor network, and your internet traffic is jumbled up with everyone else's, and it's all encrypted, layers and layers of encryption. It's re-encrypted every time it makes a hop around. So Tor originally stood for the Onion Router, or router, as the British would say. And all that means is, it's like an onion. You peel off one layer of encryption only to find an encrypted message inside that, like a Russian doll.
Yes.
And you just take it out and take it out. And that is a difficult process. It requires complicated mathematics and powerful computers. So eventually, the idea is that it's not worth the effort. It just becomes too hard. Now, Tor can also be used, if you like, the other way round, so that the destination you're connecting to, its location isn't known. And in the case of the Silk Road, which was the most famous of all of these underground locations on the so-called dark web, that was a trading site. And In many ways, it was exactly like any other buying and selling site on the internet, from eBay to Gumtree to, you know, a specialist one for real estate or whatever it might be, except for two facts. One, it was concealing its location, and two, it was trading in illegal stuff. So you could set up your account there and buy and sell drugs, buy and sell illegal weapons, buy and sell an assassination. People would offer, you know, hitman services and so on and so forth. And to keep that as anonymous as possible, you obviously wouldn't want to pay by credit card. So people Bitcoin. Would pay by Bitcoin. Exactly.
We come back to Bitcoin.
We do come back to Bitcoin. And so all the dark web is, it's nothing magical. It's just these places where people are trying to hide and do things that they don't wish to be revealed.
So you have to know what you're looking for then
That's
in order
right.
to put the web address straight in, because it's not
yeah.
something that is going to come up on your search
That's
engine.
That's right. You won't find it in your normal search engine. If it does turn up in something like that, then law enforcement authorities will contact the search engine and arrange for it to be removed. There are protocols for doing that, which is how law enforcement chases down things like child abuse imagery or terrorist material.
Right.
And so those protocols exist. And it's just the bad guys, if we want to label all of these people as the bad guys, they're just trying to hide from that process. So there's nothing, as I say, there's nothing magic about the dark web. You know, it's no more sinister than the fact that there are organised crime operations, and if you know where to know and know who to ask, you can buy a pistol or you can buy a kilogram of heroin or whatever it might be on the black market around a city like Melbourne. You know, those in the know will know where to go or know someone to ask who have a mate who can tell you which pub to go to and which side of your nose to scratch to give the secret signal. So that's what happens. Again, it comes back to our first point. Whatever human activity there is in the physical world, there's an equivalent in the digital world.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because it seems to me that if that's an area a bit like in the physical world, that you choose at some point in your life for whatever reason to wade into.
It's there if you want it.
It's there if you want it. But I would imagine it's a difficult world to wade out of, because just as there are people watching potentially your every move in the light web.
I like that, yes.
In the light web, there would, I'd imagine, even within the dark web, within the dark net, even though it's encrypted from the outside influences, the outside world, but within, wouldn't that be a whole way of monitoring? Wouldn't they have a way of monitoring each other inside?
Yes, and then you add into that the fact that a lot of the sort of, how do you break into this? Because the Silk Road was taken down by the FBI.
Now, the Silk Road is?
The Silk Road was the largest and best known of the marketplaces on the dark web.
That's right, you were talking about, yes, before, where you could get pretty much anything.
Yeah, but illegal. It has been taken down and arrests made, and it's split up because two things come into play. One is that if everyone's anonymous, well, maybe one of these anonymous people is an underground police officer trying to build up evidence around. Like, if you're buying drugs, they still have to be physically delivered somewhere, right? If you're arranging for someone to be killed, you have to say, well, here's their photograph, here's where they'll be next Tuesday afternoon. And of course, the police can just wait there for the
and
killer.
And find that out.
Secondly, this stuff, while it's they're very powerful tools for hiding yourself on the internet, you have to get it right every time. A bit like a spy has to not make a mistake. And some of the people who've been caught so far have made mistakes. The person who's alleged to have been running Silk Road, for example, was looking for help with his programming work. It's just computer software. He had to maintain the site. He needed some technical help. So he appears to have posted like a question on a programming forum using his real name or a public identity. Then he realized his mistake, erased that, but posted the same question a short time later using his his hidden identity,
which is kind
as
of,
it
yeah,
was.
Shouting out then, this was, yeah, this yeah. is dodgy!
Yeah, yeah, dodgy. Yeah. And the question was one which, you know, it wasn't the sort of question you'd ask, except if you were running this kind of
site.
Right,
okay. So it was a bit of a giveaway.
Yeah. Other people and also the law enforcement types, the FBI in particular, the Americans are kind of the most advanced on this, although China and Russia and Australia and others and Britain have very powerful tools as well. You can arrange to infect the computer of the bad guys, so it reveals its location. That kind of spyware, you know, we call it malware if it's a criminal planting it on our computers to somehow disrupt us or get money off us. But it's spyware or surveillanceware if it's law enforcement agencies trying to implant the software on the criminals.
I was just thinking, you know, that there's so much about this whole world now where underworld stuff goes on, and illegal trafficking and the communication therein goes on, that if you were making I just think there must be something about making a new Bond or maybe making a new Bourne movie where you just find yourself going, where's the action? Where's the action? There's all this stuff going on in front of computers and people are just hacking left, right, and centre.
Well, I always say hacking's very boring to watch. It's just people sitting, and it's not fast typing. People, you know, all the movies show people frantically typing at their keyboard as hacking. No, it doesn't look like that. It's mostly people scratching their chin and looking at something and trying to think it through.
Quizzically. You've got about 2 minutes to tell me the most interesting thing you learned at the Hackers Conference.
How to fake a death certificate. How to fraudulently issue a death certificate for yourself or someone else.
Right. Why would you do that?
What's
the benefit?
Well, if you can declare someone dead, you can screw up their life because all the banks will close their accounts and whatever. So you can do it for revenge. Or if you can declare them dead, you can also declare yourself the executor of their will, fake a will, get your probate declared, and steal their assets. The fun one I like, though, is declaring or creating fake birth certificates. The government's made that as easy as possible because a certain percentage of people, about 4% in Australia, never get around to registering the birth of their kids. So the government's trying to encourage that. So what you do is, well, you can just go to the appropriate website. And we were shown how to fake a doctor's identity and fake a midwife's identity and all those things and create a birth certificate. And as this guy said, look, if you have a baby, just create a couple of more while you're at it in case the first one turns out bad, gets a criminal record.
No,
and then you sort of kill that one off and move the identity to the second one. Perfect 18th birthday present, a clean identity with no criminal record. You're the best mum in the world.
This is a whole world that I know I'm a part of. I mean, to a point.
We're all part of it.
But, man, don't even know what's going on. Couple of texts to finish up. Guys, you have to get a microphone blocker for your phone as well, as Still says. People are getting ads for things that they've only talked about. Something about voice activation, hearing more than OK Google.
Well, anything you say, either OK Google this or on an Apple phone, Siri do that.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a search instruction.
But just casual conversation?
Theoretically not so much, but People worry, but you can infer things about people's interests by other things, as it were.
Well, yes.
Like if they're looking for a holiday, they're probably also looking for luggage.
Oh, see? You're good about this stuff. Thank you very much. Nice to see you.
Pleasure, Lindy.
Like literally, face to face. Still Garian in the studio. He'll be back with us again very soon, albeit from Sydney, but here for a Hackers Conference. Where else would you have a Hackers Conference except in Melbourne?